Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hi, this is Todd.
Hi, this is Maggie.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism is the idea that you can be good without a belief in God. We represent reason, science, and compassion, and we work toward alleviating and supporting the entire free thought and non-theist community.
Our guest this month is going to be Sean Carroll, but first let's talk to Maggie a little bit and get to know her. Listeners, Maggie is the Director of Development and Communications at the AHA. She is the editor of the weekly e-zine, the Humanist Network News, that hopefully you get. And if you don't get it, Maggie, how can people sign up to get the e-zine, which is pretty cool. It's filled with comics and news and all sorts of fun humanist stuff.
Absolutely. We have about 40,000 subscribers, and you can sign up at AmericanHumanist.org/HNN. It's a really great e-zine. I get so many wonderful comments and messages from people who love not only the philosophical articles about humanism and atheism and the movement in general, but as you mentioned, our comics section, our crossword puzzles, our poetry, we even have an advice column, all kinds of wonderful things. We try to mix it up. You know, we're looking to websites like the Huffington Post and Slate.com as sort of a place where humanists and atheists can read all about the news related to free thought and humanism. So I definitely encourage people to sign up. Every week, every Wednesday it comes out. You'll get to read a message from me and read all about what's going on with humanism.
Yeah, sweet. So yeah, definitely check that out, listeners. And so everyone knows Maggie has been in the movement for a number of years for a young lady. She has been involved since her days at James Madison, where she was the vice president of the JMU Freethinkers, and kind of grew up in the secular student side of things, was actually on the board of the Secular Student Alliance, and then went on to be part of the class 15 of the Humanist Institute. Now has been with AHA for how many years?
8 years now, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So tell our listeners a little bit about what you do at AHA, because I know it's the e-zine's actually a relatively small part of that.
I'm in charge of fundraising and communications here at the American Humanist Association.
Donate
so
now.
I'm in charge of That's correct. So I'm in charge of all of our fundraising programs, and I supervise our public relations work related to press releases to the media, interviews with the media, our Facebook, Twitter, and all of our social networking sites. But what's great about working at AHA is that this is really a really good community and a good set of staff who know what they're doing, are very passionate about humanism, and do their job very well. So I really can't take credit for a lot of the work that we do here on both the fundraising and communication side.
What are some new developments at AHA? I mean, we'll talk about the conference in a minute, but what else has been going on lately? Any big stories, things you've done press releases
on?
I'm
really excited about our legislative work. We've been very active on Capitol Hill. We have a full-time lobbyist on staff. And there have been a lot of crazy things coming out of Capitol Hill lately, as many of you follow and understand. A couple of things that we've been particularly working on, for me personally, is getting the U.S. State Department to recognize atheist discrimination. We've been hearing in the news, international news a lot lately regarding atheists in Bangladesh, in Indonesia, and in other countries that are being persecuted because they're atheists. They simply go on their Facebook page, post a message that says, "I don't believe in God," and 2 days later they're arrested, and they're in prison for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. And this is a deep concern. And so one of the things that I'm grateful to be a part of is a group called the International Religious Freedom Coalition that meets in Capitol Hill. And it's a gathering of many different leaders, human rights activists of other religious groups. And American Humanist Association is the only humanist group being represented so far. And it's important for all of these people to get together because we're all under one common goal, to support the freedom of and the freedom from religion. I think one of the things that is interesting, you know, I sit next to people like the head of the Church of Scientology, the head of the National Council of Catholic Bishops. You know, these are folks that, you know, we certainly don't agree with when it comes to faith and religion and things like that. But to be able to sit at a table with these folks in common goals, to have something that we do care about together, I think that's really important.
Well, I love that, Maggie. I think that that's a great way that people of faith can empathize with some of the things that we're talking about, because there has been a lot of religious persecution against religious people throughout history, and there certainly is today as well. Certainly, you know, in the Muslim world, Christians are suffering tremendously, and I think it's important for them to understand that, you know, it's not just you folks. You know, it's tough to be an atheist in many parts of the world, and it can be tough in the United States, but we got it easy compared to many parts of the world where it's, you know, it's brings the death penalty to not believe.
Absolutely. One, and again, one of the other benefits of being part of this Religious Freedom Roundtable at Capitol Hill is that I didn't realize how many minority groups are being persecuted in other countries. It's really astonishing. And they've been involved in working with the administration and the U.S. Department of State for many years. And it's something that when we realized this was happening, we said, well, of course, you know, atheists and humanists, we need to be the organization that helps stand up for these groups as well. So I feel like I've learned so much being a part of this group and learning more about the human rights work that these other organizations do. And this is something that AHA is working toward. And certainly, I love being a part of this group because I can easily support these religious organizations that are fighting for religious freedom. It's a way that we can work with religious groups and our allies. It helps us do other things on Capitol Hill and gain respect of our leaders, to know that we're all working together for the freedom of conscience, for the freedom of belief, and the right to not believe.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, I mean, that's really what the free thought movement is primarily about at this point, is gaining respect for free thinkers. And that requires people to have tolerance of other beliefs. And
in
this case, that's exactly what they're working towards. It's for people to be tolerant of their beliefs when in places where they're a minority. It's just a great segue to help them see what it's like for people who don't have faith.
Right. You mentioned about tolerance and being respectful of people's viewpoints, and certainly that is what we at the AHA work toward, and I know many of the other groups work toward. You know, we're just trying to gain respect for atheism and humanism. We want to simply be able to say, I don't believe in God, I'm an atheist, I'm a humanist, and not have that negative stigma attached to that. You know, we want simply people to say, okay, great, and move on.
Indeed. So there was actually a lot in the news this month that related to humanism and atheism. One was good news. There was actually one week in particular that was like Atheist Christmas.
That is a great way to put it. I see it that way too.
There were like three big things that happened in one week and got the media all frothing and excited. So the three things that happened all at once, and we'll take them individually, is one, Johnny Mendez in Arizona gave the invocation before the state Congress. He's a state congressman there, and actually gave a humanist, essentially, or I guess specifically more secular than humanist, invocation, which was amazing, big story. The Pope came out and said that atheists can be redeemed and God doesn't discriminate against us, and it's more about being good people and doing good works than anything else. And then his staff quickly reversed that. But you can't reverse the Pope's staff, Catholic doctrine. Come on now, the Pope, Pope's infallible, right? And then Rebecca Vitzman in Oklahoma, whose home was destroyed by the tornado, was interviewed by Wolf Blitzer. It's like, yeah, you gotta thank the Lord. Actually, I'm an atheist. It was such a great week, and you know,
it was amazing.
And some of the people I spoke to in the press were talking about this as, you know, a turning point for the humanist movement, because it was, you know, three really big media stories all at once, all positive stories for us. And it was just awesome. So I'd love to get your thoughts on those.
Personally, I think that indeed, yes, this is a turning point. You know, our motto at the AHA is good without a God. And these three stories are examples of how you can be good without a God. I mean, even the Pope essentially said that you can be a good person, you can be an atheist without a God. And so already we're seeing our mission accomplished. And in just this 1 week, it's just been incredibly exciting. I got the opportunity to meet Juan Mendez at the conference. He was able to attend at the last minute and speak to our attendees. He had a wonderfully inspiring speech about humanism, about his values, and about the need to encourage others to come out as an atheist and run for public office as well. I think that's exciting. And we were able to show him at the conference that there is a huge humanist community out there that is ready and willing to support atheists, to support humanists, and folks who are interested in running for public office. So yeah, it was a very exciting week. Atheism was talked about like crazy. Humanism was a part of the entire discussion regarding being good without God. So I hope that we have more weeks like this. And I think that this week in particular really showed how the work that we're doing is translating into real results and people actually being changed and affected by humanism.
That's a great segue into the conference. AHA just had its 72nd annual conference, and Maggie and I were there. I had a lot of fun. I thought the speakers were particularly awesome this year. I really enjoyed a lot of the talks, and I've been to a lot of conferences now, but I thought the talks were unique and refreshing and a lot of new topics and a lot of new speakers. So I thought from that perspective, it was awesome. And were there any particularly kind of cool stories or takeaways or fun things that you experienced or saw?
Well, you know, one of the things I love about the conference, in addition to attending the wonderful lectures and getting to meet all of these speakers who are very passionate about humanism and atheism, of which I should really give a shout out to all of our speakers at this year's conference. They did an amazing job. We've already been getting a lot of feedback from our attendees who are really excited about the folks that they got to listen to and meet. But I think one of the things that I think is most interesting at the conference is sort of what happens between the talks and the lectures. So many people just love to network and talk and get to know each other. I see people, you know, moving off to a corner to have, you know, an even more detailed discussion about one of the lectures that just happened. I love folks who just walked up to Dan Savage and Katha Pollitt and Greta Christina to shake their hand, take their picture, and talk to them about something that's very important to them, humanism or atheism or something that they talked about during their talk. You know, Richard Dawkins was very gracious and was available throughout the conference from Friday through Sunday talking to folks and attending sessions. I think that this is one of the great things about the conference. It's the community. It's getting to meet people one-on-one, you know, put names to faces, and be really a part of a larger free thought movement. I think that this is one of the most exciting things about conferences. One of my favorite parts was after Dancing Matt Harding, who was one of our speakers. He's the YouTube sensation who does all of these great videos traveling around the world and dancing with folks. At the end of his session, he got everyone together to do a dance and be part of a video. And even after that, people wanted to individually dance with him and take pictures and videos. I mean, that is just so fun. You know, he brought so many smiles and laughter to our attendees. I think that that particularly is something that I won't forget. You know, it was just such a fun time and an enjoyable part of the conference that people got to do. You know, talks, very important talks by Richard Dawkins and the Richard Dawkins Foundation regarding religious child maltreatment. That was something that I think a lot of folks recognized as not only an important issue, but something that we really need to do something about now. It's all part of, again, not only being a part of the community, but recognizing some of these issues that are so important that some action needs to be taken. I think the conference motivated people to take action when they can and to be able to be a part of again, the greater movement. So I think the conference was really fun. I certainly hope and encourage folks to attend next year's conference, which is going to be June 5th through the 8th, 2014, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We'll have information on our website at conference@americanhumanist.org. I think it's just one of those great and wonderful opportunities to get to know AHA staff and leaders, meet, you know, people like you, Todd, meet other speakers, and meet other humanists who are really, really involved in this movement.
Exactly. So our keynote speaker at the conference was actually Sean Carroll, and he's our guest this month. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Sean?
Well, Sean Carroll is a physicist at Caltech University in Pasadena, California. So it wasn't too far away from San Diego. And so I thought that this was a great opportunity to have a humanist physicist be our keynote speaker. And what's great about Sean is that he was so engaging during his talk. I particularly liked how when one of the audience members asked about the Higgs boson, which he writes extensively about, and why the Higgs boson is called the God particle, even though obviously it has nothing to do with the concept of God, he cleverly replied that we really shouldn't be calling the Higgs boson the God particle anymore because now we have evidence that it exists. So I think that he's just incredibly funny and very witty and is able to explain physics in a way that, you know, lay people like myself and many others are able to understand. So I was very excited to have him there. It's very important, too, that we have more scientists, physicists, biologists, and others associated with the humanist and atheist movement. I think science is an incredible key component of humanism, and the more folks like Dr. Carroll and others that we can have associated with us, the better.
Thanks for joining us on the show, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the convention. I'm looking forward to your keynote address tomorrow. Any sneak preview for that?
I don't know whether I should be giving out sneak previews, but I'll be mixing up some ideas from physics and cosmology with ideas about, you know, purpose, meaning, morality, why we're all here kind of stuff.
All in one shot.
Yeah, in the first 15 minutes, and then it'll get complicated after that. Right.
It's good you keep it nice and broad.
I like to be humble, yeah.
Yes, right. This is good. You give us the secrets of the universe, and moral and cosmological all in one shot.
That's right. Yeah.
That's perfect. So tell me about, first of all, for our listeners, tell us about your path to humanism. How did that come about for you?
Well, I was always interested in science. I started, mm-hmm. you know, when I was 10 years old or something like that, getting seriously interested in physics. In fact, what I would now know as theoretical physics, the cosmology, black holes. And you read all I could about it, read science fiction also. And I was raised in your typical sort of milquetoasty, suburban American, somewhat religious family, but not that religious, you know,
okay.
Like it was okay to go to church, but if the priest or pastor started talking to you, my parents ran away. And so I wasn't either especially devout or especially atheist, but you know, the more I thought about it, it did seem to me more and more unlikely that God existed. And then I ended up going to a Catholic university, to Villanova University, for college, because I got a full tuition scholarship and they had a very good,
that's a good reason,
astronomy department. Yes, that's right. And it was actually there that the light clicked on and I realized that it was okay to say out loud that you didn't believe in God. And I took many classes in theology and philosophy of religion and things like that. I had a great time and learned a lot and came out, you know, 100% vocal in my humanism and materialism.
And that was perfectly okay in a Catholic university. Did you receive any pushback or challenge?
It wasn't really pushback or challenge so much as, you know, there were times when I clearly didn't fit in. Like the idea of a charity was, you know, the pro-life movement. And I was not big in, you know, supporting that charity in the same way that some of my friends were. But, you know, I was hanging out with the scientists and with some of the professors, and we had a very good time. Most of the professors were also religious, but they thought I was just adorable. So we had a great time talking back and forth.
That's awesome. Now, I've seen you prefer to identify as a naturalist above other terms. Why is that?
I don't mind being called humanist, atheist, or whatever, but I think that if I were to volunteer a word to define mm-hmm. myself, it would be naturalist, because it seems more of actually saying what I do believe in rather than saying what I don't believe in, namely that there's the natural world and there's nothing else. There's the natural world that obeys rules. Those rules are amenable to discovery by us. We are part of it, and it's our job to understand it and to try to fit in.
Somewhat of the if the supernatural exists, it's natural, not supernatural.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting question. I actually organized this little workshop on naturalism, and we babbled a bit about how hard it is to define naturalism. But what I realized only too late was that it's actually really easy to define naturalism. It's hard to define anything other than naturalism. It's
exactly.
hard to define supernaturalism, right? But of course, in practice, naturalism means not only that there's the idea that it's all the natural world, but then in fact, we have a fairly good idea of what that natural world includes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just that if ghosts and the afterlife were real, we could fit them in to a natural way of thinking about them. It's that, no, we should take the evidence that we have pretty seriously and say that ghosts and the afterlife are not real.
Yes. Now, you used to teach a class on atheism at the University of Chicago, I saw. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, there was at Chicago, they very famously have a broad-based curriculum, a lot of required courses. And in the early years of your undergraduate education, you get all these survey courses, seminars, and you'll be introduced to great ideas across the board. And then as you went up through the years of your college education, you would specialize more and more and get more technical courses in your major. But there was this guy, Bill Wimsatt, who is a philosopher of biology at Chicago, and he had the idea that we're training all of these students and then not letting them be sort of interdisciplinary and big picture oriented mm-hmm. toward the end of their career. So he put together a series of courses called the Big Problems curriculum, where seniors in the university could take these sort of seminar type interdisciplinary courses. So a friend of mine and I, Shadi Bartsch, who's a professor of classics, we proposed, someone out of just orneriness, to teach a course on the history of atheism as an intellectual idea. So not, you know, proselytizing for or against or whatever, but just exploring how atheism developed, a subject which between the two of us we had absolutely no professional competence in whatsoever. So we were open about that. You know, we did the reading ahead of time. We learned about it. We probably assigned way too much reading to the poor students because – anything that has to do with atheism is anything that has to do with religion, and it's mm-hmm. a lot of reading that you could end up doing. But we learned a lot ourselves. You know, the idea of calling yourself an atheist is a fairly recent phenomenon, historically right. speaking, but there were certainly precursors that go way back.
But what other big problems did they take on? Was this like the Templeton Foundation taking on the big mysteries?
Well, it wasn't, you know, there's a little bit, it wasn't involved with the Templeton Foundation, but there's a little
Good.
Bit of that element of it wasn't completely free of ideology, let's put it that way.
Interesting.
But in this case, the ideology was sort of a crunchy liberal save the world kind of ideology. So the big problems that were typically looked at were, you know, the environment, crime, globalization, and whatever, which were fine. But, you know, so our big problem was whether or not God exists.
Fascinating. So tell me about physics. What got you into physics in the first place specifically versus other areas of science? What drew your passion there?
Yeah, the short answer is I don't know. You know, there's
perfect. You're agnostic and an agnostic physicist.
That's right. Agnostic about the origins of my interest in physics. You know, we live in this world where you have to make up your mind about what you want to do for a living way before you know what there is to do for a living.
Indeed.
And I always loved science, and I always loved physics in particular. And that part of my decision-making process was absolutely right on. There's no part of me that thinks I should have been a chemist or a biologist or an engineer or anything like that. Physics, the parts that I like, can be very, very abstract. You know, I'm thinking about quantum field theory, general relativity, the origin of the universe, the nature of quantum probabilities. And I don't need to do experiments. I don't need to have a lab. I don't need to blow things up or endanger myself or my students. I can just think about ideas, and other people can do the hard work in the lab. And they'll pay me to sit around in Starbucks with a piece of paper and a pencil and think about where the universe came from. So it's just a pretty awesome vocation to be part of.
Nice. Now, my theory is that in the beginning there was God, and then he blew up, and that was the Big Bang, and we're currently living on the remnants. I think we're on the uvula right now.
It could be.
Is this something that's been proven yet?
It has not been proven yet, but there is the interesting story of Georges Lemaître. He was a Belgian priest, and he was also a physicist. He got his degree from MIT, studied at Harvard also, and studied physics back in the early days of the 20th century. And more than anyone else, he is responsible for what we now call the Big Bang Theory. He was the one who took Einstein's general relativity theory, applied it successfully to the whole universe, played the movie backwards in his mind, and realized that there was a moment when everything was on top of everything else, which he called the primeval atom, and we called the Big Bang. It is more or less a pretty straightforward, hard-to-avoid conclusion of relativity that there was something like the Big Bang in the past. And so that's the first time when people could sensibly argue that there was a beginning to the universe based on science rather than just on guesswork. And he was a priest, a Catholic priest. He became the Vatican Observatory Director for some time, or at least a science advisor to the Pope anyway. And at one point, the Pope wanted to use the Big Bang Theory as confirmation for the Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo, that if we now have science telling us that the universe came into existence, well, you know, fiat lux, let there be light. Here we were right all along. And Lemaître strongly argued against letting the Pope do that. He never let his scientific work and his theological work get mixed up together. And he made the very true point, which is that, look, Pope, he probably didn't call him Pope, but whatever you call the Pope, if you're a Catholic priest. He said, you know, the problem with science is it's about hypotheses, you know, and the hypotheses can eventually be shown to be wrong. You know, if you say, look, we were right because the universe had a beginning, what if some future physicist realized, no, the Big Bang wasn't a beginning, it was just a phase and the universe is eternal? Does that mean that we were wrong all along? So he just argued against using discoveries in science as evidence for pre-existing religious beliefs.
Which makes a lot of sense. You don't want to pigeonhole yourself on current science, because science changes.
It's a good strategy if you don't want to ever be ruled out. Of course, the correct scientific strategy is exactly the opposite. You get points for sticking your neck out and saying that someday I could be proven wrong, and that will mean I was wrong.
This is not how religion works.
It's not how it works. That's right.
So what do you think happened before the Big Bang? Do you think that was the beginning of space-time, or do you think there were multiverses beforehand and were one of many? Do you think it's been eternal? What do you think, and what's the current leading theory or hypothesis?
I think that there's two options, both of which are very much on the table. The Big Bang was the beginning. At least it was the beginning of what we call time as a physical concept, and there was nothing before that. It was like what is north of the North Pole is the famous analogy. It's also completely possible there was something before the Big Bang. Strictly speaking, the Big Bang is not the beginning of the universe. It's the end of our understanding of the universe. That's where our equations give out. Our theories are not up to the task. But we know that our theories are not up to the task, so we shouldn't take them seriously at that point. We need better theories. We need an understanding of how quantum mechanics and gravity play well together. My personal suspicion is that the Big Bang was not the beginning of time, that there is something before the Big Bang, that we need to make better theories to understand how that might have worked. But I'm certainly by no means dogmatically wedded to the idea. It's where I would bet. But if we get a better understanding theoretically or any experimental data, for crying out loud, then we would actually, I'd be happy to say the Big Bang was the beginning.
So what do you think was there before?
Well, I think that quantum mechanics is fundamentally more fundamental than what we now call space and time. I think that just like quantum mechanics back in the early 20th century said that it's not really electrons, it's an electron field that vibrates everywhere and you can see electrons in different places when you look, I think that space and time are kind of overrated, space especially, and what happened before the Big Bang might not be describable in terms of stuff moving through space. It might just be some fundamentally quantum mechanical phenomenon that doesn't have that sort of billiard ball, classical physics kind of analogy. I don't know. We're trying to figure things out, but there's no reason to expect that that's an easy question we're going to have the answer to anytime soon.
Right. Do you think there was a prime mover at some point in time whereby there was something that a beginning point, or do you think that it was whatever happened beforehand may have been eternal and that, like, some sort of cycle that there was never a I guess what I'm asking is, do you think there was a point where everything started?
Yeah, my personal guess is there was not a point where everything started. The time is eternal. It goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. And you might ask, given that both alternatives are on the table, why have a preference at all? Why even have a favorite belief? And what we do is we take the laws of physics where we do understand them and we try to extrapolate them into the regimes we don't understand. So if you just look at quantum mechanics, if you put apart general relativity and Einstein and all that stuff, and you look at the laws of motion of the universe as given to us by quantum mechanics, then every moment in the history of the universe is just as good as any other moment. There's no sense in which the universe crashes into a singularity or reaches a boundary or comes to an end or anything like that. There's a rule given to us by Schrödinger's equation, that says how the state of the universe evolves through time for all of eternity. And I think that that rule is more likely to survive into some future understanding of physics than anything else we now know. So my guess is that our job for the future is to put together a complete history of the universe that goes from the eternity in the far past to eternity in the far future.
That would be wonderful to have.
Yeah, full employment for physicists. We're not there yet. Yeah.
what are some current ideas in layman's terms for our listeners for how we might be able to get any good evidence for what happened before the Big Bang?
Well, like I said, we're not there yet. And it's, I need to emphasize, it's a very, very minority pursuit, even within physics. You know, most physicists are spending their time doing real work, thinking about atoms and materials and lasers and fluids and plasmas, you know, building better batteries to run our cars and things like that. There's a very small fraction of us who think about particle physics, gravity, cosmology. And even among those, there's a very small fraction who are thinking of what happened before the Big Bang. It's not like, you know, a major worldwide effort. Having said that, you know, what's very difficult to predict is when the progress will come or how it will come. We have very little evidence. You know, well, it depends. I shouldn't say very little. We have a lot of evidence, but it's crude. We have evidence for what the state of the universe was a long time ago. It was hot, it was dense, it was smooth, there's certain perturbations, there's certain amounts of matter and energy in different proportions. But what are you going to make of that? You know, it's not like you can do an experiment and restart the universe in your laboratory in any easy way and
dangerous.
See what happens. Right. So it is, you know, it's a little bit like paleontology, except much, much harder, right? You can't run the fossil record again. You have to work with what you have. And so we have what we have. We're trying to get a few more pieces of information. Is it possible that there were other regions of space, other bubbles of universe that bumped into our universe at early times? Is it possible that, you know, we learn more about dark matter and dark energy that tell us about this stuff that make up most of the universe? Is it possible that we discover new particles at the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, gravitational waves from the early universe? Many, many things that we're looking for and hoping, crossing our fingers, but it's not like we have a 10-year plan to figure out where the universe came from.
Tell me about the multiverse and the concept, what that is for our listeners.
Multiverse is an interesting idea. It has many different flavors. If you talk to a modern cosmologist, what they usually mean by multiverse is the universe is very big, and in different regions of space, the local laws of physics look very different. So we live in a part of the universe where space itself has three dimensions, where there's some particles called electrons and quarks and neutrinos and so forth, and there's four forces of nature. Somewhere else, you know, space might be five-dimensional, and there might be a whole different bunch of particles and forces. And this idea of the multiverse, this cosmological multiverse, it's not a theory. It's the prediction of other theories that we like for other reasons. Theories like inflationary cosmology that says the early universe was accelerating at an amazing rate. Theories like string theory, which tell us how local laws of physics can take on very, very different forms. So if you believe in these certain other theories, the multiverse is something you just got to deal with. And then the question is, can we actually take that unfortunate situation where the universe is, that we see is far from unique, and somehow use it to make predictions, to say that, well, in a typical universe, if space has three dimensions, then you get these kinds of particles and forces or something like that, right? And again, we haven't succeeded in doing that. That's something very, very difficult for which the experimental data are only marginally helpful. But it's a very, you know, plausible scenario given everything that we know about how space and time work. So you can't just dismiss it because we don't like it.
So in this multiverse theory, is it kind of one big universe with different parts of it?
That's
having
right.
different laws of physics, or is it like bubbles within that are kind of separate universes, and there's many universes?
There's both ideas on the table. The more popular and well understood version is that there's only one thing called space evolving with time, and in fact you could call that the universe. But then there's little regions in space called pocket universes where the local laws of physics or the local cosmological conditions seem different to us. So all those pocket universes add up to what we call a multiverse, even though they're all connected to us. If you could go faster than the speed of light, then you could visit all of them. Since you can't, they're inaccessible to us, even in principle. But we call that the multiverse, even though they're all connected to each other. There's also the possibility that there are truly disconnected parts of reality. Maybe they were connected in the past. If they're not connected either now or in the past or in the future, then it doesn't seem to be much use in talking about them.
Is our observable area through various observational tools that the microwave background?
Microwave background, leftover radiation from the Big Bang,
Are all those observable areas part of our universe all obeying our laws of physics? Or is there anything we can actually see through various tools now that might be a part of a different multiverse?
Yeah, so the part that we can observe is, you know, fixed in size, because light travels at a fixed speed. 1 light year per year is the easiest way to remember it. And the universe has there's a fixed number of years since the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years. So you trace light backwards in time as you look to the far away things, you're looking into the past, and there's a point past which we just can't look. So it's very, very possible that very far away in the regions that we cannot see, the conditions are very different, and we would call that the multiverse. It's also possible, but it's a little bit less probable, that these bubbles of different regions bumped into each other at early times, that there was another thing, another region of space that was going to be its own universe, but it smacked into our universe early in its history. And so now it's wiped out, but maybe it left behind a remnant, a sign, a little, a small perturbation of the density or the conditions early on in our universe. And it could be very, very subtle. So it could be there in the data that we already have in our hands, but we just haven't yet been able to make it out because the signal-to-noise ratio isn't very big yet. But this is an ongoing project. You know, we're developing the mathematical techniques necessary to ask the question, given this radiation we see from the Big Bang, is it more likely that it just came all from one place, or is there little bumps and wiggles that might indicate that different universes were smacking into each other at early times?
So, and I'm sorry if any of these questions are naive because I'm not a physicist,
right.
So is it that you're almost looking for an echo of a potential collision in the past?
No, you're really looking for a collision. So
you're actually looking for the collision itself.
That's right. Because what happens is that in space, what we call one of these pocket universes forms because it's what we call a phase transition. It's like water melting from ice to liquid water or boiling into water vapor. Space itself undergoes a phase transition. And a bubble forms in a small region of space, just like a bubble in boiling water, and then it grows at the speed of light. And inside that bubble is the pocket universe that we're talking about.
So, which I guess we could be in now.
Right. So one of those bubbles could have expanded and become our entire observable universe. But while that expansion was going on, maybe another little bubble formed just outside of our universe, but then smacked into ours. So it's a small bubble hitting a big bubble, leaving a circular impression on the early universe. So we're looking in the microwave background in the cosmological sky for little circles that might have a slightly anomalously high or low density or temperature or something like that. And then even if you did find it, you'd have to convince yourself that the best, most economical explanation for that was another universe bumping into you. And that's a little bit of work involved there, but, you know, got to keep our eyes open.
So you wrote a book recently about the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the book and why it might be fascinating to them?
Yeah, this is all about the Higgs boson, which, you know, I have a whole chapter explaining why it should not be called the God particle. And the joke was, you know, after we found it, we can't call it the God particle anymore because there's actually evidence it exists.
It exists.
But it's
Higgs doesn't want to call the
He hates the idea. Most physicists are not fond of that label. But the label was given by a Nobel Prize winning physicist, Leon Lederman, who was trying to sell it to people who had trouble understanding why the Higgs boson was so important. And that's really what my book is about, too, trying to help people understand what's the big deal about – I mean, we found particles before. We found the top quark. We found all these sorts of particles. And there seems, from an outside observer's point of view, to be a bit more excitement about the Higgs boson than about the other particles. And there's a couple reasons. One is that the Higgs boson is the final piece of the standard model of particle physics, which explains every particle that I am made of and you are made of and everything we've ever seen with our eyeballs ever in our lives. So that's a very important milestone in human intellectual history that we've put together this theory
of humanity.
Physics. Yeah, yes. but also because the Higgs boson plays a different kind of role than all the other particles. One of the lessons of the book is that it's not really particles that make up the universe, it's fields right. that make up the universe. So the obvious example of that is the electromagnetic field, which we see vibrations in the electromagnetic field, and we call those photons, particles of light. But in fact, it works for everything. There's an electron field, there's a quark field, neutrino field, etc., and there's a Higgs boson field. And the reason why that's important is because, unlike all those other fields, the Higgs boson field is taking on a substantial value even in empty space. So in empty space, the electron field or the electromagnetic field or the gravitational field are basically turned off.
Okay.
Whereas in empty space, there's a whole bunch of Higgs field there. And what that means is that all of the other particles are moving through the Higgs field like you move through the air when you wave your hand or something like that.
So the Higgs field is providing resistance of some sort?
It's almost providing resistance. What it is it's constantly interacting and basically giving heft to all the particles that move through it. And that heft we refer to as mass.
Okay.
Exactly. So without the Higgs field, the electron, for example, would be massless. And massless particles, Einstein says, move at the speed of light. And if electrons moved at the speed of light, they would not make atoms. And if you would not make atoms, you would not have chemistry, molecules, or life. Because of the Higgs boson, electrons have mass because they feel that Higgs influence as they move through empty space. Therefore, they can fall together and make atoms and make you and me.
That's why it's called the God particle, because without that, God couldn't have created Adam in the first place, because he would have been moving at the speed of light.
All
and
his
that
particles
been
would have been moving at the speed of light, yes. That is
Got
right.
it. Okay, that now right. it's all Glad fitting together. Thank
yeah.
you. So what's an application for day-to-day life that these new discoveries are going to make? What's going to change now that we know more about the Higgs field and the Higgs boson?
Now that we know about the Higgs field, what changes is we know about the Higgs field. There are no...
Awesome!
Also, I wrote a book, and you can buy a book. That's what has changed. There are no technological applications of the Higgs boson that we can even contemplate, much less imagine building. And when I say this, people get up in arms because they say, look, we didn't know about the applications of radio waves
right.
or quantum mechanics or blah, blah, blah. The difference is that, and that could be true. I mean, maybe some super genius who is not around yet will come up with a technological application of the Higgs boson. It's not a matter of airtight predictions. It's just a matter of being realistic about what is possible. Even though we didn't know about electrons or radio waves or quantum mechanics before they were discovered, they were still all around us, right? There were radio waves around. Mm-hmm. There was light. There was quantum mechanics holding up the table, et cetera. And we started putting them to use once we understood them better. There are no Higgs bosons hanging around. The lifetime of a single Higgs boson is 1 zeptosecond, which is 10 to the minus 21 seconds. And to make that 1 Higgs boson, you need a $9 billion particle accelerator 17 miles around underground in Switzerland or something equally impressive.
You don't have one of those?
I don't have one of those, but the Europeans have one of those.
We don't have one either, do we?
Yeah, we do not have one.
Whoops.
That's another whole sad
story. America.
but the point is that, the Higgs boson is not something you can collect in a bucket and try to build something with, like you could do with electrons or radio waves or, lasers or something like that. So it is the reason why we built the Large Hadron Collider and looked for the Higgs boson and are excited about finding it is because we want to understand how the universe works, not because we want to build a better iPhone, cure cancer, or anything like that. Of course, having said that, the process of finding the Higgs boson leads to all sorts of technological spin-offs that have nothing to do with Higgs bosons.
Right.
Superconducting magnets, computer technology, data transmission, many, many good things come out of spending money on fundamental science, but the Higgs boson itself is not going to have any direct technological applications.
Could it have an application potentially in the future on space travel and like our ability to, the sci-fi geek in me is
right.
like, ooh, wormholes. Like,
yes.
Can we tear the Higgs field apart and pop out on the other side of the universe?
Right. So the answer is no.
Don't.
So I'll give you a simple reason
I guess maybe
why.
That's good. I mean, decreases the chance of highly advanced visitors showing up.
Yeah, there's other ways you can try to build wormholes and things like that. But the point is that, it's not the Higgs boson that is responsible for you having mass. It's the Higgs field in empty space. Now, as a footnote to that, the Higgs field is responsible for electrons having mass, but not for you having mass, because most of your mass comes from protons and neutrons. And most of that comes from the strong nuclear force, quantum chromodynamics, not from the Higgs field at all. So, in fact, if the Higgs field went away, your diet plan would only lose about less than 1% of your mass. It would not actually be
elimination of the Higgs field is not the new Oprah diet.
It is
what you're saying.
No, it is not. It is very expensive. but also, so number one, the Higgs is not really responsible for most of your mass. Number two, it's not the Higgs boson that is giving you mass; it's the Higgs field. Number three, so what if you said, okay, I will try to manipulate the Higgs field. If the Higgs field has some big ponderous value in empty space, I'm going to try to build a machine that reduces that value to zero so that electrons are massless. Well, It takes energy to do that. And you can calculate, let's say that you have sort of a 1 centimeter region of space, you know, size of a marble, and you want to decrease the Higgs field from its current value to zero inside that marble. Well, E equals mc squared, Uncle Albert Einstein has told us. So if it takes energy, then that marble now has mass because of its displaced Higgs field. How much mass? It's about the mass of the Earth. So if you want to decrease the Higgs field to zero in a marble-sized region of space-time, you have to convert every particle in the Earth to energy and put it to use with 100% efficiency. This is not something that is in your or my lifetime in terms of technological achievement.
That almost makes me feel safer.
Yeah, I think of all the things to feel unsafe about, particle physics is not high on the list.
So you have a blog as well, Preposterous Universe. Tell our listeners a little bit about that, where they can check it out, what its theme is.
Yeah, I started blogging way back in 2004, and originally at Blogspot, and I called my blog Preposterous Universe. And then I joined a group blog called Cosmic Variance, and we were picked up by Discover Magazine. But then various things happened. Discover Magazine got sold, and I was missing the sort of good old carefree, independent Wild West days of the blogosphere. It seems that these days all my friends are part of collectives and magazines and things like that. So I actually went in the – I de-evolved. I went back to just having my own personal blog and my own personal website, preposterousuniverse.com. And the great thing is I talk about whatever I want to talk about. And no one tells me what to talk about because it's just my website. I'm paying the bills. I'm losing money doing this. I'm not getting paid. So often I talk about science. Often I talk about philosophy or religion, atheism, naturalism, humanism. Sometimes I talk about movies or cartoons or cats or poker or watches or whatever I want to talk about. So it's not a public service. It's just a me service. It's just whatever I think is interesting. And fortunately for me, other people sometimes read it.
I do love movies. What was your most recent post on movies?
Post on movies.
Or a movie.
You know, I'm fortunate enough that I have worked as a consultant for a number of Hollywood movies, science-wise. And so I've, you know, given tiny little insider scoop tidbits about, you know, Thor and Tron Legacy and other movies that I've worked on. It is my fault that Natalie Portman in Thor calls the Bifrost Bridge an Einstein-Rosen Bridge, and then it has to be explained that that really means a wormhole, because I was in there in the meeting with Kenneth Branagh, the director, and Kevin Feige, the president of Marvel Studios, and I said, you should call it a wormhole, and Kevin Feige said, we can't call it a wormhole, that's 290s. So I said, all right, you can call it an Einstein-Rosen Bridge, and that's how that line got into the movie. So, but, you know, that kind of work is helpful, as unscientific as Thor was as a movie. Jane Foster, the character played by Natalie Portman, in the comic book, she's a nurse. And they wanted to give her something, a job for the movie that would be more useful to the story they were trying to tell. And, you know, with our help, they made her a particle physicist, you know, exploring interesting atmospheric phenomena, looking for evidence for new scientific theories in the New Mexico desert. And the sequel is going to come out this year, and I helped out with that also. And there may be dark matter involved in some way. That's all I can say.
Perhaps.
Perhaps, yes.
Any dark energy?
I can't even say that.
So not
the subtitle of it is The Dark World. That's the title of the movie. So,
well, speaking of video, and not to hint that I may have left my preparation till the last moment, I saw on your blog,
yes,
like, the most recent post was a post on a new video series you're doing on interesting science topics. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about this new video project you're doing and video blogging, I guess it?
Yeah. This is actually not my idea originally. It's a group of people who are trying to come up with a new science-oriented web video content site. So both curating existing videos and also creating some original content. And they asked me if I'd be interested in doing, you know, little interviews with other scientists and informal chit-chat to make science seem fun, but also get a sense of scientists talking amongst themselves rather than just being mediated through the media somehow. And so we did a practice video. We had a great conversation about neuroscience, about which I know almost nothing. But, you know, it's just the usual thing. There's so much good science there. It's far too much than we could fit into a short little video. So I think, I think it was fun. It was interesting. I'm not quite sure what the future of it will be. Certainly, I think that the channel has a very bright future. I think that there's so much good science content out there. If someone can organize it, it should be, very, very helpful to a lot of people. Whether it needs more science content by me, I'm hopeful. It's fun. It's not going to replace my day job, but I have a lot of fun talking to smart people. So it's a good excuse to do that.
That's awesome. Any fascinating physics facts that our listeners should know? Something most lay persons wouldn't know, but would be something really cool that they probably should know or would appreciate knowing.
Oh, boy. I mean, there's just too many.
I give you one, and
yeah,
only
okay.
One. No, if you have two really great ones,
hints, yeah.
That's just fine.
The things that sort of swirl around in my brain are the ideas that we don't know whether they're right yet or not, because that's what we're doing research on, right? As a working scientist, you're thinking about the speculative ideas, not the things that you understand perfectly well. So let me give you two little ideas. One is very speculative. It's called black hole firewalls. This is a fairly recent idea, just from last year, less than a year old. If you pick up a textbook in general relativity, such as the one that I wrote, it will teach you that if you fall into a black hole, you won't even notice. A black hole is not an object. It's not a thing that you hit, you smack into, or anything like that. It's a region of space-time with the property that if you ever go in, you can never come out again. It's a point of no return. But when you actually cross that threshold of no return, the event horizon, it's just a plain old ordinary region of space. You don't even notice yourself. It's a sort of global feature of the universe, not a local barrier. Or at least so we thought until last year when some very, very smart physicists at UC Santa Barbara wrote a paper saying that if you include quantum mechanics and Hawking radiation, then in fact they think that when you cross that event horizon and fall into a black hole, there is a wall of very, very high intensity radiation that you pass through and are burnt far longer before than you can actually cross into the black hole and hit the singularity. They call this the firewall, which is bad nomenclature because computer firewalls keep you out, and this firewall sort of burns you to a crisp. But they claim that at the edge of a black hole, it's very, very noticeable barrier that you can't pass through unscathed. Again, very, very controversial, brand new. No one knows if it's right or not, but it's a very cool idea if it's true. The other idea, much older, that I think is actually much more likely to be right, but is even more mind-boggling, is the classic many-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. The idea that when you observe some quantum mechanical object, an electron, so you don't know where it is before you see it. It could be here, it could be there. After you observe it, what we ordinarily say is the wave function collapses, and you now see it in one place, and that's where it is. But back in the 1950s, Hugh Everett, a physicist, a student at Princeton, came up with the idea that what really happens is that the universe splits. This is another version of the multiverse. Part of the universe says the electron was over there, and now there's a copy of you who saw it over there. And there's another whole copy of the universe where the electron is over here, and there's a copy of you who saw it over here. And these two separate copies of the universe split and can never talk to each other ever again in the future. The simple laws of physics, the fact that you observed this quantum mechanical particle that was in a superposition of different possibilities. And instead of bringing one of those superpositions to reality, which is the conventional view, Everett's view is that they're all equally real, and every one of them becomes true, but now they're true in separate possible parallel realities. And this sounds like the worst kind of science fiction, but in fact, I and an increasing number of my fellow physicists think that this is right. And we are, trying to develop the framework in which to make mathematical sense of this point of view, use it to make predictions, see if you can answer all the questions you want to answer. And, one of the lessons of science is you don't get to pick how reality is. You got to choose what best fits the data. And we think that this is the best fit.
So if I'm understanding that right, that would result in infinite numbers of universes?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly a very, very large number of universes. One question is, what counts as a quantum mechanical observation that splits the universe in half? And there are answers to that that are not completely worked out yet. We have a good idea. It has to do with an idea of what we call decoherence, and the system you're observing is interacting with the environment around it, and there's only so much precision that interaction has, so it might only be a finite number of universes that are really created. That's one of the questions we need a firm answer to if this whole scenario is going to make sense.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So, do you have anything else you want to talk about or add for our listeners?
You know, I think that part of what I'll talk about tomorrow, and, you know, is, again, going a little bit beyond science all by itself, but the lesson that I will try to be pushing is that as humanists, we need to develop an understanding of human life, what it means to be a human being, what it means to be a good person, you know, what it means to have a purpose in life, meaning in life, stuff like that. Physics will never give you that. Physics only says what happens in life. Science will never give you that. I do not believe, like some other people believe, that morality or ethics will be reduced to scientific exploration someday. However, whatever you come up with for your personal theory of morality, ethics, purpose, meaning, etc., better be compatible with the scientific view of the world. It better not involve entirely new categories that aren't there in the scientific picture. And so that is the challenge for future intellectual progress of humanity. You know, in some sense, physics is the easy part of science. Physics says, let's ignore all of the complicated bits, right? Let's strip things down to their most fundamental descriptions, talk about the simplest possible things that nature can do and figure out what those are. And then that's a tiny part of what science is. A lot more of what science is describing the complex, emergent, higher level layers of reality, biology, sociology, what have you. And the human aspects of meaning, purpose, which are outside of science, need to be compatible with that whole multi-layered, rich description of the natural world, but are not fixed by that whole description. So it's this fine line we have to walk between figuring things out in a way that is compatible with science, but not relying on science to give us all the final answers. And I would say, personally, we're very, very far from achieving a complete understanding that we can rely on. But, you know, journey of 1,000 miles, single step, and all that.
Well, as a humanist, I'm all for having worldviews congruent with reality.
I think it's a good, you know, first checklist item that you should have on your agenda. Yes.
It seems very reasonable. Well, Sean, thank you very much for joining me here on location in the Higgs field. I appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
So that was Sean Carroll. I had a lot of fun getting to interview him, although I have to say he was a challenging interview, not because he's challenging to work with, he's actually awesome to work with, but because it's really flipping hard to keep up with him and talk about physics when you're not a physicist. So I hope, listeners, that that was all comprehensible and that it was also interesting at the same time, because that's what I was trying to do. If it wasn't, feel free to let us know at our listener comment line, which is 202-618-1371. And if you think it was great, please let us know that as well. So anyway, you can find Sean Carroll. He's at preposterousuniverse.com, and his latest book is The Particle at the End of the Universe, How the Higgs Boson Leads Us to the Edge of a New World. Let's see, listeners, a couple other quick things I need to point out. You can check out our Facebook page. Please like us on Facebook, which is the Humanist Hour Show, and you can also find us online and find previous episodes, to which there are many of them now. Lots of awesome speakers in the past. You can also find show notes and links on the show at thehumanisthour.org.
And folks, if you're interested in attending a regional humanist conference, we have a few coming up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, September 13th to the 15th, the Pennsylvania State Atheist Humanist Conference. And you can learn more at atheistpa.org. The AHA is a co-sponsor, and I'll be there as well. So you can meet me and meet other leaders at the American Humanist Association. And there's another local regional conference being hosted by the Humanists Doing Good of Colorado. Information is Colorado Secular Conference, and the website is www.cosecularconference.org, and that event will be held in Denver July 20th, so hope to see you there.
Well, Maggie, thank you so much for joining us this month. I liked having you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Todd. It was great talking to you.
All right, listeners, till next month, have a great one.
I've got a secret I have to share. Out from the closet and into the glare, I'm an atheist, a non-believer, a man of peace. I'm not gonna eat you. Time to clear the misconceptions, prejudice, and false perceptions. Just because we don't believe in a deity doesn't mean that we lack morality. It doesn't come from a book or a prayer. It comes from within. We've evolved to care. It's part of being the human species. We left the trees, stopped throwing our feces. Evolution is fact and theory, mountains of evidence gained through inquiry. You can't put myths in a science book, and creationism is myth understood.
time was, would be burned at the stake for apostasy and rejecting faith. But here we are, against the odds, we're shouting out,
there are no gods!
Humanists, agnostics, and atheists.
Come on, come out wherever you are.
Sparkle like a diamond, glow like a nebula.
We're skeptical and doubting, we're secular.
We shine a hard light on faith. We're good without God and we're here to stay.
Yeah, that's right, we're here to stay. Come on, come out, don't throw it away. We're increasing in numbers demographically. There is no hell and our Sundays are free. Our parenting is beyond belief, because we have to give our kids some relief from dogma and indoctrination. Critical thinking is good for a nation. No child is born a sinner. We understand that they're just a beginner in life, and lifelong learning, give them the knowledge and the yearning to improve upon the human condition, to lose the need for superstition. Don't need to repeat the Inquisition. Independent, my mind to keep. I'd rather be a cat than a woolly sheep. Enlightenment thinking, I try to steep. My mind and body takes the leap. Have to question everything we're taught and practice the fine art of free thought. It challenges the mind and stops it shrinking.
Look at me, Ma! I'm free thinking!
Woo! Humanists, agnostics, and atheists.
Sparkle like a diamond, glow like a nebula.
We're skeptical and doubting, we're secular.
Standing between church and state, we're done with all the gods before the human race.
Don't get me wrong, I don't hate religion. I accept it's a personal decision where you're free to believe and free to choose
to question the pulpit or kneel in the pew.
Freedom dies in theocracy, that's why we're a secular democracy. So let's roll up our sleeves, apply our moxie, and shake the pillars of orthodoxy. And just because I'm not religious, there's no real reason to be suspicious. You'll be pleased to know and much relieved, there's plenty that I do believe.
I believe
in common sense, I believe in evidence. In working hard for a living, I believe in loving and giving.
I believe
in protecting our earth, it's all we are and all we're worth.
I believe
that human rights is worth the anguish and the fight. Same sex and marriage goes together like a horse and carriage.
I believe
that education is cheaper than incarceration.
I believe
that social justice is when this nation is at its strongest.
I believe
in kicking the rear of the business of greed, lies and fear. This is the place and the hour to stop the abuse of privilege and power. And then we're gonna need a shower. Humanists, agnostics, and atheists.
Atheists!
Come on, come out wherever you are.
Sparkle like a diamond, glow like a nebula.
We're skeptical and doubting, we're secular.
Secular.
We shine a hard light on faith, we're good without God and we're here to stay.
Humanists, agnostics, and atheists.
Atheists!
Come on, come out wherever you are.
Sparkle like a diamond, glow like a nebula.
We're skeptical and doubting, we're succulent.
Succulent.
Between church and state, we're done with all the gods before the human race.
Heretic, atheist, blasphemer, non-believer, apostate, godless, non-religious, unchurched.
A diamond glow like a nebula.